Welcome back to the podcast. What else? It's August, a totally off month, a very pleasant month. Nothing much seems to happen, but you never know. There's always, for me personally, in my personal life, there's usually been a surprise in August. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, back in the days when I listened and watched cable TV, I don't do that hardly at all anymore. I'd have it on in the background. And, you know, at night, I will say I usually flipped on Chris Matthews, the Hardball Show. Chris Matthews has been caricatured, and often by the left in promoting him, like that he's a really cantankerous guy who argues, and I just never really saw him that way. Here's what came through to me. The guy had real-world experience. You could tell. He had worked on Capitol Hill. He had worked in the White House, and that brought special insight and substance to whatever the hell it was he was saying on TV. I didn't see a blowhard like some other people saw or thought they saw. I saw a pretty thoughtful person. Granted, I often disagreed with him, you know, but not too much. He was really like a guy calling a game, and I thought he could call a game pretty well. It's like, okay, if he's rooting for another team, whatever, you still see the state of play, and at least back then, 3 years ago, you didn't deny the state of play that was happening. You called it for what it was, and he did that, I found. I've always found him to be a person of substance, basically, and have a mutual contact, and I thought I'd give him a call about his book, which I did read. It's Chris Matthews, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. Just, of course, I'm throwing out this name. You know this guy, of course, again, from MSNBC and the McLaughlin Group and CNBC, NBC. He's been a fixture for decades. And he also has an interesting or life lesson or two that he throws in this book, and he's put in previous works that that I enjoyed. So here is my conversation with Chris Matthews. You know, one thing I wanted to ask you right off the bat, if you don't mind, when you ran for Congress, my theory is this, when anybody runs for Congress, they see themselves, if they do it before the age of 30, or say before the age of 35, they want to be president in some way, shape, or form. They think of themselves as a future president. When I thought about running for Congress, I did. So you must have, when you were 28, I mean, that must have been in the back of your mind, like, if I win this, anything can happen next.
Well, there's no doubt that having grown up in the aftermath of the John F. Kennedy experience, that we thought of the Congress as a stepping stone to the U.S. Senate. And, of course, the U.S. Senate put you in a chance to be a president. And clearly that was all part of the picture. Although I'm not sure I really thought about it a lot, I thought more about the reaction that I was having to Watergate and to the possibilities that things would really explode, that people would really throw them out in 1974. That, of course, I didn't think about spending the rest of my life in the Congress and the House. I think that's probably accurate.
You know, Nixon said that his highest political elation, the most joy he ever felt, was the night he was elected to the Congress. And
I agree. I think that was pretty clear. I've read all those books and I've written about it myself. And I think the idea of going from being a sort of a nobody, if you will, a bureaucrat in the government, you know, a guy who hadn't really seen action in World War II, he hadn't really distinguished himself. A guy who looked up to Eisenhower as an almost distant god, for him to join the ranks of elected U.S. officials was clearly an incredible threshold for him, to go from nobody to somebody, to the guy that Jack Kennedy would look up to for many years as a major figure in politics. I can see that as an honest statement by Nixon.
And it's kind of within striking distance of not just, well, kind of theoretically anybody. You know, I mean, you're not that far removed from your congressman. If you want to, if you work hard enough, you know, you can make a credible try for it. Anybody can, in a way. And I just kind of...
It depends. I was running against the Democratic machine in Philly, which was it's still active. It's 67 wards. They hand out a sample ballot, it's called, but it looks like an official ballot. And it tells people how to vote in the primary. Most people vote the party line. They take the endorsement of the local leader, and unless he cuts you and crosses out your name. And they also, people to get through the line, they just go by the numbers on the back of the official ballot. It tells you your ballot position. And a lot of people just simply vote their ballot candidates that have been endorsed by their local committeeman or committee person. And it's very much an old system. And I was running against that. That's why getting a quarter of the vote was a challenge, which I didn't need. But I wanted to win, of course. I wanted to win that primary.
Well, I love that that experience and so many others that you had on Capitol Hill and Peace Corps. I mean, this is one of the reasons why you are a breakout broadcaster, in my opinion. You have all this real-world experience that very few journalists do have, relevant experience.
It helps with my writing, too. When I write my book, I've written 9 books down. It helps my perspective on the challenge of getting elected, the real goings on behind those closed doors on Capitol Hill, the chicanery, the shenanigans, if you will, that go on in both parties, that is part of American political life. It's not all big speeches before big audiences on television. You know, a lot of it goes on in the back room, as it is right now in the U.S. Senate. The back room is where it's happening right now.
And very few people understand. And, of course, your books. I mean, I first became acquainted with you, as I think I mentioned on the phone, on the McLaughlin Group. And you were all kind of insiders there to varying degrees. I actually had an interesting moment with Jack Germond, and it was kind of noteworthy. I'll tell you about it in a moment. But, look, let's just go to Tuesday. Those cops, well, before that, I think a lot of people are still surprised that you were a Capitol Hill police officer, and I was surprised you actually carried a gun. How did that come about? And tell us.
Well, I came back from the Peace Corps in Africa. I didn't know anybody. I basically wanted to be Ted Sorensen. I wanted to be a speechwriter for a president. I wanted to be a legislative assistant to a senator to get there. And I knocked on doors. I went to a couple hundred doors, knocking on doors. I didn't know anybody. And finally, I got a break because Wayne Owens, a young Kennedy supporter, had been Rocky Mountain supporter for Bobby Kennedy, had worked with Ted Kennedy in the Senate. He liked me, and he gave me a job after a little tryout. I had to respond to a complicated tax question from a constituent, which I got the information for at the IRS. He made me a Capitol cop, which meant I would work in the afternoon from 3 to 11 at night. In the mornings, I'd work in the office writing speeches and answering complicated mail. And that was the deal back then. A lot of people had those patrons. Harry Reid, the former Senate leader, was a Capitol cop. Mike Barnicle was a cop. These were patronage positions. A lot of them go to rich kids whose father or mother had given money to the politician and gave them the job so they could go to GW Law School or Georgetown Law School, something like that, or AU or Catholic. They go to law school in Washington based upon the $8,000 they were getting from the Capitol Police jobs. So it was a fairly common thing back then.
You actually carried a gun. You talk about your marksmanship qualification, which is kind of humorous. It's in the book. It's great. It's not exactly the police academy.
How about the 5 bullets they gave us in case we tripped and fell? And they didn't want us to shoot off a round accidentally.
Yes.
They only gave us 5 bullets in the gun.
I love it.
It was really not dangerous, the job. It was dangerous only in the craziness I showed in walking up Southeast Pennsylvania Avenue in the evening to get some dinner. And nobody else did it. I never realized why nobody did it. They didn't do a lot of it, just saving money. But I would just walk down the street with my uniform on and my gun and dress just like a Metropolitan Police officer in D.C., anybody trying to rob a store or anything, kind of street crime, and I would have been right in the middle of it and without any real training in how to deal with crisis situations. I was very lucky and probably strange on my part to even risk it, but I did it every night. So
it's so cool, and that's part of you forever. Now, you felt a special connection to the cops the other day you testified. Just you wrote about it in the Washington Monthly. I just, what are your thoughts on those gentlemen?
Well, and, I these guys, the four guys testified, were the most powerful testimony I've ever seen. And more important than their testimony was the body camera tape that played. And the horror of the guy's groans and the feeling that you could feel you had that he was being tortured basically by the mob. The complete craziness of it, the horror of it. And also, when that officer and the other officers mentioned different places like the West Terrace store or the crypt, these are places that I would go around the night checking on. And I'd be with crowds then helping the tourists move around and direct their traffic more or less and patrol the court, the line, the rope lines that kept people in different places. I used to walk with friends of mine when they'd come to the Capitol and show them the bullet holes in the ceiling of the stairway going up to the statuary hall, the old house chamber, and from the crypt. And all these references were so real to me. And, of course, when that day happened, I felt violated. I felt like a place that I'd worked in. I'd become top aide to the speaker. I'd been all those years working as legislative assistant to the senator, Senator Frank Watts, and then to Ed Muskie. I had been in that building basically for 15 years off and on, and I knew how sacred it was and how the police, for example, how they treated these speakers of the House and people like that with such reverence, the way they would approach their doorways. And I just remember I have this image of the light coming out from the office, the glow coming out of the speaker's office, and the way that the Senate, the Capitol police officers and the officials, the top officials, treated those areas of almost sacred religiously, like how they protected those spots from anything happening, going wrong, and or anybody showing any kind of desecration. And here was a desecration on a grand scale on January 6th, where these people were racing through everything that I believed in. And it was, I once sat alone I sat alone in the rotunda one night, just trying to imagine Jack Kennedy's coffin there in the middle of the room and all those historic paintings around the walls. And the Capitol is our cathedral of democracy. It's where everybody since the 1780s and early 1790s certainly were coming every 2 years because they were elected by the people to be our government. And to have this mob rampaging through it, you know, I didn't like it.
And I totally understand your reaction and the connection you have. It's amazing. And by the way, your trip to Washington as a kid, very reminiscent of what I went through with my family, and it evoked the same feelings. But I had a different reaction to these officers, and I just kind of want to run it by you. I was really taken aback by how politicized their testimony was. One officer, Gunnell, he said that Republican members of Congress who are lobbying or asking questions about those still incarcerated as a result of January 6th. He called them pathetic. When Fanon slammed his hand down and said the indifference has been disgraceful, and he yells, the other guy had lots of snide observations about Trump supporters and what they look like and things like that. And it reminded me of that tour I took to the Capitol when I was a kid in 1985, a White House fellow I knew, and he told me how five members of Congress were shot right there in the House of Representatives, and there was a bomb that had gone off. And I just kept thinking that this is not the worst thing that ever happened at the Capitol. And these guys, you had to see, or did you see, the potential for them to be exploited after a year of, you know, the country in riots and violence against police seemed to be normalized, if not glorified. I was troubled by it. And I don't know. Did it bother you at all? Does what I'm saying make sense?
Well, I have no idea. I noticed that they did have a political bent in the way they made their statements. I don't know who helped them put their statements together. They had that attitude about the mob. I think they were still shaken by it. They still have an attitude about it. Nobody likes being scared. When you're scared, you get angry. That's a lot to do with the way people react to street crime. You don't like walking down a street being scared. And you get angry at the person who makes you scared. This is a very human reaction. And they, those guys were scared that day. And they have an anger toward people that made them scared. And they saw the violence. And they couldn't use their guns. They shouldn't have used their guns. It would have been a Boston massacre. And anybody second guesses that, I think, isn't thinking through the situation. And I think the I don't think this is a partisan issue to me. And I don't think it's, I think a lot of this is just like COVID. It shouldn't be partisan. There's no ideological aspect to these. There's no historic difference. It's a question of the country's gotten so divided that it's, the fight is more important than the issues. It doesn't have to be a real issue. There's always a fight now. Every time one side says something, the other side says the other, just to keep the fight going. On any issue that's raised, it seems that there's a 50-50 divide because the other side always reacts to what they just heard, you know, not violently, but vehemently. And so I agree with you. There was some of that, but I think in this case it was understandable, and I don't think it detracts from their testimony. Because these guys are under oath, and they're under oath as officers and under oath as witnesses, and I don't think you're going to find any deviation from the facts here.
Well,
and we're going to get more of this.
Cops, you know, they face danger in the line of duty. That happens. And you know, we saw cops being beat up in New York. And, you know, for a lot of us, and I lean a bit conservative, and I that Ashley Babbitt wasn't mentioned. It just, I don't know what good was accomplished. And I wonder how these officers can serve on Capitol Hill going forward, where a guy like Sergeant Gunnell says that the members, you know, who are doing what they think is right are pathetic and they should no longer be members of Congress. Like, that's...
Well, let's turn this around. You're a Republican member of the House and you voted against the investigation, or you voted in a way that suggests you think the election wasn't honest, that there was some justification for that riot. You have a police officer's job, it is to defend those people, but they totally disagree with it. They think those people are outrageous, but they will defend them. One of my interesting stories that I told and put in the book was back in the 1970s. I mean, 50 years ago when I was a cop, it's a long time ago, and chatting late at night, there was not much going on. And I was talking to a building engineer, the kind of super that comes around and fixes things that go wrong in the building. And he'd been there for years. And he told me about the only liberal senator that ever said hello to the cops when they walked past and showed any kind of human reaction to their existence, much less their role as their protectors or guards. It was Bobby Kennedy, because Bobby was very, I wrote a book about it, very pro law and order, as well as being a liberal on a lot of social issues, but he was a law and order guy who believed that people obeyed the law and supported the police. So I would like to think that, to turn your question around, I would like to think that the Republicans and the others, and all of them, you know, including the elite liberals, who I don't always like that much, all showed respect for law enforcement. And maybe we'll have a little more comedy between those protected and those protecting them. It seems to make sense to me. If you have a bodyguard, you like that person because that person is keeping you alive in some cases. So it seems to me that in this violent time, that there should be a little more good relations between all the members of the Congress. They should all say hello when they pass the window.
Well, that was 50 years, and I remember that, and that resonated with me as well. I could see that happening. You know, the country is a bit more, egalitarian in a way. I mean, look, we're not like that anymore. I can't imagine, I'm sure some blow off Capitol Hill cops, but there's probably before January 6th, you know, in politics, you never know who's going to... who are you going to be working for someday? I mean, everybody knew that Harry Reid was once a cop. You just never know. So there was comedy around of that. I'm talking about on Hill.
I just think, let me put it this way. I remember being in New York after and hearing about it after 9/11. And the yuppies, which we used to call the young, well-turned out, well-educated people, who had great prospects in their lives. When you're sitting in cafes, three cafes, on the sidewalk, and they'd cheer when the firefighters drove by in the trucks, because there was an appreciation of what those guys had done on 9/11, climbing up the stairs and everybody else was coming down. This class distinction, which is prevalent inordinately among liberals, is a problem. And the term deplorables, by Hillary, was part of it. The sense that the people who didn't have good education, who didn't grow up in families where everybody read the New York Times, are somehow below you, morally and humanly below you. Well, that's one reason why Trump is successful, the perception that that's going on. So I'm pretty keenly interested in this conversation because class is something we don't like talking about in America, but it's a big reason for our politics and the way it's heading right now.
You know, Chris, I'm looking at, I've got your book here, picture of you with Tip O'Neill, which fascinating, but there's something about this I want to ask you. You're taller than Tip O'Neill. How tall are you?
Well, I think I'm shorter now. I'm 75. I mean, I'll break the bad news to everybody listening. When you get older, you get shorter. I mean, I think I'm about 6'2". I was 6'3 and a half at one point in my life. And Tip was 6'3", too. I guess I was, it's different camera angles there. Tip was not just overweight. He was big. He was a really big man. He was 6'3". I think he was in the high 200s. He was a very enormous physical presence when you're with him in the back room, I can tell you. When I first sat down with him, I was overwhelmed. He had these big, strong butcher arms. He loved to wear short sleeve shirts to show them off. He was a very strong man. Of course, Reagan was a strong guy, too. But in fact, Tip used to say, Reagan, because he touched him one time on his shoulder, he said, God, you're strong and you're fit. And Reagan said, it's from chopping wood. And Tip went out and tried to chop wood one day that he didn't like. It didn't work very well. He was worn out pretty fast because it does take a lot of effort. But, you know, he's a big guy, but not about the same height.
Well, you talk about his physicality, his presence, and he used it. And I kind of wanted to ask that about you.
Certainly used it in the back room. He would close the doors when there was a tough fight going on in the caucus. And he would get about 15, 20 guys in the room, some women, of course. And he would smoke that cigar of his with the door closed. And that room got so hot. And he also had this wonderful technique of yelling at the person he was about to agree with. And people would come out of the room and say, boy, you tore him a new one and all this language about how tough he was. And they ignored the fact that he had just found in favor of the guy he attacked because he had a way of sort of working the room that way. And mostly people just wanted to get out of the room. It was so incredibly hot and smoky. But that was part of his craft, his trade craft.
And it's a part of it's in politics. It really does count the physicality, your charisma, presence, or whatever, in person, not just on television. And you know, I've never met you, but I saw you once at the Bloomberg party after I guess the White House Correspondents' Dinner, and you got out of a car. You know, 6'3" and a half. I think you're 6'4". You're tall. You got a bunch of people around you. I mean, you've got, and I'm not trying to, this is just a statement of fact. You've got a certain star quality to you. And I am actually curious about all this life of adventure that you've had. You know, walking in the room when you're 6'4", 6'3" and a half, whatever, I mean, that's an advantage. And I think people, I'm asking you, did people see you as, okay, this guy's a future star. This guy's got something going. And it's almost an animalistic reaction. I mean, there's something.
This is pretty amazing. I've never had this conversation before, so I don't know how to react to it. You know, I don't know. If you're on this, I am the same guy on TV all those years. I'm the same guy on this conversation. There is no other pose or poise or whatever. If that's true, it's true. I never heard this before.
Well,
to be honest with you.
I mean, look, there's a reason why most of our presidents are tall or have been over the years, right? I mean,
well, before television, yeah, George McGovern was taller than Nixon. He broke that pattern, yeah. And I think TV equalized to people in terms of height. But like all the movie stars we grew up with, Paul Newman, Redford, none of them are tall men. And yet nobody, you know, Alan Ladd, nobody seems to, or Bogart, nobody seems to care. It's an interesting thing.
Well, it's most of the people on television, most of the anchors still are pretty tall. And there are notable exceptions.
Scarborough's tall. Brian Williams is tall.
Dan
Rather.
Rachel's tall.
Yeah, let's see who else.
Rather's
yeah,
tall. Jennings
Hayes
is tall.
Chris Hayes is tall. I don't, among the women, they're above average. Let's see, Rachel is, I think she's very tall, I think. Who else? Nicole, I don't know. Yamiche Alcindor, I don't think so. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know. I'm not sure. Oh, Mika Grzynski's tall. You're right. You have a pattern here, yeah.
Well, the impact is not, by the way, with the viewer. The viewer doesn't care. I think it's with people off air. The people that you meet with who give you those jobs on air, they are impressed. They got a lot of people to choose from. Everybody kind of wants those jobs. And I think that there's a lot there that is never really discussed. But anyway.
I think you probably would be, yeah, I think social psychologists would probably back you up on that. I think that's true.
But, and so do me a favor, Roger Ailes was kind of very important in your career at points. I mean, he, tell us a little bit about.
Two points. And, you know, I went to Holy Cross College and Joe McGinnis went there and he's one of the stars of the school. And he wrote a lot of crime books, but before that he wrote Selling the President. He also wrote three times a week to the Philadelphia Inquirer, at least twice a week. So maybe three times a week. So he was one of my heroes growing up. He was a couple of years ahead of me. He was writing his book on Ted Kennedy. It didn't do well, but he invited me to have dinner with him. We met for some reason at the Grill, a great place in Beverly Hills. And after dinner, he said, I'm going to meet somebody afterwards you're going to like. And I said, who is it? And he said, Roger. I said, he's the enemy. He's the guy that did Reagan and Nixon and all that stuff and all that stuff in the 88 campaign. He's the enemy. And he said, no, you don't like this guy. So we went over to the Four Seasons Hotel. I think it was a walk. We got in a cab or whatever. We got over there and I had a few beers with Roger. And I liked the guy. We talked about an idea I had because I had met anybody like him before, a big time consultant. And I had this idea for a half hour fast paced TV show once a week, which was going to do with be like a time capsule for people that didn't like to watch television, but would keep up with the key events of the week, whether it's in sports, movies, politics, whatever. And he went back to his office in Murray Hill in New York. And he worked up the plan and he had this plan he's working on. It was a kind of a formal proposal when I visited him up there. And next thing I knew, he's been named ahead CNBC in this new network, America's Talking. And I called him up and I said, what about that show? And he gave me the show 5 nights a week. I got approval from Will Hurst, William Randolph Hearst III, who was my publisher at the San Francisco Examiner. And next thing I knew, I had Monday through Friday TV show, thanks to Roger. And he just made the judgment. And so, yeah. I certainly owed him for that, and owed him for my TV career, you might say.
He hired me as well, by the way, at Fox News Channel, and I love that you acknowledge his role in your career. You made me think of something, though. Sorry to go back. One thing in this book that you don't talk about at all, or hardly ever, is Biden, Joe Biden, and I would imagine that you cross paths with him quite a bit. You must have profiled him.
I cut the book off at the 2020 election, I think, and because it was due. And I didn't talk. Biden is Biden. I think people see him and who he is. I mean, he's a middle class, regular guy, as he wants. He's not ideological. He's a moderate Democrat, I guess you could say, unhyphenated Democrat. He once said, I was the guy that wore a sports jacket during the 60s to say I was not he didn't wear an army surplus jacket like a lot of others did, like me. I don't think he went to the anti-war rally. But he is what he looks like. I mean, he is Joe Biden is Joe Biden. I don't think he's not a complex person from what I could tell personally. He has a wife he's in love with, and he had all this tragedy in his life. You know, he took the positions on busing and things like that that were appropriate politically. Let's put it that way, to his state, which is a strange state. Delaware doesn't have a swing county. It has the South, which is definitely old Confederates or it was definitely slaves, and it has Wilmington, which is black, and it has the suburbs, which is DuPont, upper middle class. But those three worlds, I don't think they ever add up to any. They just add up to a state that's now Democratic. It had been more Republican. But he doesn't have, who is he loyal to? The southern part of his state? Is he loyal to the black city? Is he loyal to the upper middle class suburbanite who works for DuPont? He has to put it all together. And I think that's what he's doing politically right now, that coalition he's trying to hold together with AOC at one end and Manchin at the other. And I just stumbled into something that's interesting, a parallelism between his state constituency and his party constituency now, which is a polyglot of a number of different points of view, to put it lightly.
Well, to go back to where I first noticed you on the McLaughlin Group, just these indelible memories I have when I'm forming my political outlook. And I remember Mort Kondracki going off on Joe Biden and how shallow he was and how silly he was. And when he got caught lying, there's that clip.
About Neil Kinnock?
No, forget. No. Put that aside, because that before or after that came to light, that footage was discovered of him in New Hampshire lying about everything he'd ever done educationally. I don't know if you've seen this. It's just like...
No, but I know about it. I know about the coming third year class at Syracuse Law School and that sort of stuff, yeah.
And just a guy who could do that in, out loud while he's trying to get people to like him, I find it shocking that he's president. But I kind of have an inkling as to, look, he got lucky when he was 29 years old. And you just said Delaware is a complex state. Not really, is it? I mean, look, how many votes does it take to become a senator in Delaware? 200,000?
Well, look, he got elected because he put together a drop. It's called a drop. It was a literature, John Martella did it from up in Boston. It looks like a New York Daily News. It's a tabloid. And you open it up, and the first page, perfect, Marcella, on the front cover, it says, Joe Biden is making an impact in the U.S. Senate, and he hasn't even been elected yet. Then you open it up, and on each left side page was a picture of him with a major senator like Phil Hart of Michigan or Scoop Jackson of Washington State or Webb or Humphrey talking to them in some great senatorial setting in the Capitol. And on the right-hand side is all this text, content about why he's really hot on the environment, consumerism, energy, things like that. It was a brilliant piece that was hand-delivered the weekend before the election to everybody in the state that did not have its own TV station. They used Philadelphia affiliate in Delaware. It was a brilliant piece of marketing, and he won. And it was an upset. And the problem was that Caleb Boggs had been around a long time. He'd been twice a congressman, twice governor, a couple times senator. He had been around. He saw the furniture. And Biden looked at this young guy losing his hair, tall, sort of classic black Irish-looking guy with curly dark hair. The whole thing. And he won. But, I think a lot of it was just his smile and his charm, People always say about Biden, either you like him or you don't. There's nobody in the middle on the guy. You go for that strong personality or you don't. And also, I think you were talking about this with me a while ago. This image of Kennedy, it's no doubt was in his head. I mean, he had to be a senator before he's 30. He had to be good-looking. He had to be some sort of glamour person. He had to be an excellent person. So I think all these self-improvements in his biography are part of that, this image he was trying to project. There's no doubt about it. It was image building. But I can't answer your question why he would make those claims that weren't true. I don't know. What do you think? Why do you think he did? Why did he say these things that were so particular that were wrong?
He's incredibly arrogant. He's a superficial man. I don't like him. I don't want to put you in an awkward position. I mean, I know in your book here, you're so glad it was Joe Biden, the 46th president of the United States, who saluted the openness to newcomers. But I just found, why is he president? They picked him because he is a liar. They picked him because he...
They picked the Democrats were confronted with Bernie Sanders. And coming out of Nevada, if you just go through the timing, Bernie won a big sweeping victory in Nevada. Biden came in second. It was high teen somewhere. And they look forward to that. They're really going to do what they did in 72 all over again, where they're really going to throw the election with somebody that's so far left that cannot win a general election. And I think that it wasn't just the black vote in South Carolina. I think there was a recognition by Amy Klobuchar and Pete Buttigieg and ultimately Mike Bloomberg that they had to get out of the way and let the one moderate win. I think there was shape of the field. And once it was him against Bernie, he could do it. And I think that the other moderates were out. I think people, I have to be a romantic about politics to some extent and believe that some of the progressives and all the moderates said our only chance to beat Donald Trump is Joe Biden. That's what I think happened.
No, I understand that. I just feel like, though, he was perfectly, he's pliable. He's willing to be used. And here's the moderate guy who's now running as a leftist or governing as a leftist, or I guess he's struggling
well,
there.
Well, that's the coalition. Look, Nancy Pelosi, who's a sharp counter and a tougher speaker than Tip ever was in terms of keeping the corral, keeping people corralled, she has about, what, five votes to play with? That's it? And if the squad goes against her, she can lose on these votes. You need 218 to do anything. I don't like a lot of the way she has to do this, but she apparently has decided she has to say, I'm not going to send, what is the two things she said? I'm not going to send the president one of these infrastructure programs. I'm not going to send the bipartisan one unless I also send the one that we pushed through reconciliation on a party line vote. And then she's also said, I'm not going to pass the bipartisan bill in the House until we get the Senate to pass the Democratic $3.1 trillion bill. That's tough. That's playing hardball with her, and we're going to see what happens. The Democrats and the country could end up with absolutely nothing. I can see that happening here. It could happen if this thing comes apart.
Overall, how much of this, look, let's face it, politics is a great big game, and it's a business, and there's a lot of stuff going on. How much of this really is about helping the people? Maybe that sounds like a naive question, just the way, but you know, it seems like it's really far removed from what they're really thinking about. I mean, and what I was surprised when I briefly explored running for Congress, I remember like an idiot getting ready on the issues and just studying. And then when I went through those meetings, all they wanted to do was talk about money. It was not anything other than money.
I know all about that.
So I just, how much of this stuff is a game and how much of it is really about people?
And the world that they live in, they're with their spouse and their children and their brothers, and maybe in some cases their parents, in that world, they talk about both. They talk about the values that they're in there for, and they also talk about their survivability in that world. And those two worlds are always conjoined. The politician, someone once said, a friend of mine, a smart guy, Sven Holmes, he was a federal judge later, he once said to me, if you walk into a politician in his office, when he's thinking about the grand scheme of things, about why he's in the business of politics, why what he cares about, liberal or conservative, and start talking the next election with him and polling, he'll think you're some kind of crude being. What are you doing in the room with me? You're the wrong person to be around me. And yet if you walk into the room and they're worried about the next election or a bad poll they just got, and you start talking about the climate change concern or about racial whatever, equity, they'll say, are you crazy? I'm trying to get reelected next week, buddy. So you have to know what mood they're in. And in fairness, in human life, people do have different moods in which they're thinking about the people and poverty or things like that that matter to them, or government overkill, which a lot of conservatives are always worried about, or the people they don't like or whatever. But you got to figure out what mood they're in. People are both. Now, some are more one than the other, obviously. There's some crass people. I think they dislike the job and the prestige and the travel and whatever, and the big shot them. And there's others a little more St. Francis about it. They actually care more about the goal than they do about their own survival. But, you know, read Advise and Consent. Read Jack Kennedy's just the part of the book he did write, which was when he talked about how politicians are scared of them losing. They're always scared of losing.
I think Biden is definitely in that latter category. It was always about the business and just, I don't know. I deeply.
Hey, Greg. Greg, you're entitled to that opinion.
Yeah.
But I know everything you've said in this conversation tells me that you have backup for that position. And that's a position that some people are, as I said, there's some, you know, I've watched Biden a lot, and I've seen all this stuff that you've described, the bad stuff. And I've also seen the guy, he won't quit. He just won't quit.
Hmm.
He's been through a lot of tragedy in his life, and he will not quit. He just keeps going forward.
Yeah.
He's almost 80. I think he'll run again. Okay. I'll give you some news here. I think if he believes he's competent, and I mean competent to read the newspaper, know what's going on, smart to make the decisions, thinks he has the mental stamina to make tough decisions in a crisis, which is the key reason we have a president. It's not to show up every day. It's to be ready when the tough question comes to him. Is he got the conscience and the consciousness of the world we live in to make the right, sensible decision, and hopefully visionary decision? And that's the question that you or everybody else has to ask them when we have the next election. Do we want somebody in the office that there's questions about that? And that's going to come to the fore. It'll probably be the biggest question of the 2024 election. Is Biden still able to do this? It's probably going to be the question in everybody's heart, you know? Unless it's him against Trump, and then that'll probably, Trump will be the biggest issue again. I don't know. By the way, I think Trump was still the biggest issue, and he'll be the biggest issue perhaps in 2022. I think he has that same will to go on that Biden has. He isn't going to go sit somewhere. He wants to be in this thing.
It is amazing. Would you'd have to grant Trump this, that he's not one of those presidents who's aged in office. I mean, he is as vibrant as he was. I mean, you might find him coarse. He might be disgusting, you know, all these things. But he is, you know, he's still with it. And the energy level is astounding.
I do think he has to, look, this is, I'm not his doctor, but he has to watch his weight. There's no old fat men. There are no old fat men. Men have got to stop eating at some point in their life. It has nothing to do with politics. Physical, the one physical thing you can do in your life if you're a male, women have a harder time with this, is lose some weight when you get older. I've gone through it myself. I lost a lot of weight. And the only way to do it is to walk, walk and walk and walk. I did it last night. You know, I'm starting to gain again. It's just something you got to keep your eye on. And I wonder about the guys. Just, how does he keep doing it? Physically, I don't know.
Well, I saw him about 4 months ago, and he had lost weight. And
that's good news for him and his people.
He's on, yeah,
no, he's matters.
Mindful of it. Hey, can I ask you real quick about Joe McGinnis, a hero of yours? I like him a lot too. He's obviously died, but did you know him? Did you get to know him at all?
No, just that one night. He was such a hero to me to go from college. It's ending up with in a year or so. I think he worked at the Worcester Telegram, and then he had the Philadelphia Inquirer, which I grew up with. And to be writing these, you know, the Vietnam column, he wrote about the graves registration, how they used to pack the bodies for delivery back home, the guys who were killed. It was just a stark writing. And then, of course, when I was the Peace Corps, we had copies of Song of the President. There was one copy, I think, in the country, 50 out of 40 guys. Passed it around across the country to read this book. I just knew him at a distance, you know, and I saw he would get big issues about, you know, what's his name? The story talking about the guy who's accused of killing his wife.
Oh, Jeffrey McDonald.
Jeffrey McDonald, yeah. And that story, I knew that whole issue. And his challenge of his career, he was trying to make a living as a writer.
Yeah, and he struggled a bit. His son, Joe McGinnis Jr., wrote a piece in The New Yorker about 5 years ago, and after his father died, it was pretty tough. I didn't know he was an alcoholic, a drug addict, all those things, at least according to this piece. And I met them.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was not a kind piece, although there was some, you know, love there, but it was really tough. It's in The New Yorker, Joe McGinnis Jr. I think he works for the government, by the way, in D.C., and he's a writer himself, right. But not. Can I just ask you about this? Do you watch the Sunday shows anymore?
I watch Chuck.
You watch.
But up here in the Chuck Todd. But up here in the, and it's like we don't have a TV. I rely on NPR, and I have Sirius Radio, so I can get all the MS shows and other shows on radio. But no, we just made a decision. We come up here, not that TV.
Well, again, when you were on Hardball and throughout your career, I mean, you had a way of connecting with the audience, and you mentioned this in the book. You know, what is this guy's take on the news and companionship? You understand a lot about broadcasting that very few broadcasters do, in my opinion. Leaving aside Chuck, what do you think of the state of television news right now? Just is it something that is on the... Obviously, it's declining in viewership, but what are your thoughts overall on its health?
Well, I grew up with political argument being very important, and argument, not agreement. I always thought the Martin Gronsky told me the purpose of his show every week was to let people know where the issue was, where people were arguing, where was the point of dispute. And I always liked that about cable when I was first starting it. If you were an immigrant from West Africa, for example, I used to meet a lot of these guys, whether drivers or doors, working at hotels, whatever. And they would learn very quickly in this country what our political conversation was about by listening to these shows, the cable shows. They were quick to learn the idiom that way, so it was a great way to learn our language, not just the words, but the culture. And so I think that's what it was good. Today, I mean, Aglowski was a classic because you have arguments between George Will and Carl Rowan and James J. Kilpatrick and Hugh Saadi, and have real arguments and about the Middle East or whatever, about the Cold War. And that's missing today. I just came upon this realization. What I don't like is show after show, Fox or MS or CNN. I echo that. The anchor will say, I echo that. Or do you agree? It's an open question. Do you agree that? And I go, oh my God, what is this about? What, do you agree that? Yeah, I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. There's no more for showing, as a friend said. There's no argument. There's nobody saying, I disagree completely. Just, I'd like to hear that once, just on any of these shows, with the guest disagreeing with the anchor saying, I disagree completely. Or, that's not the way I look at it. Or, you forgot about this. You're not telling the whole story. And I think the great thing about growing up in America was watching the crime shows where they say in court, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but? Nobody's out there telling the whole truth. They'll give you the advantages of infrastructure, but not the disadvantages of inflation. Or they'll say black lives, which I'm all for, but then they'll go to defund the police, ignoring the fact that how many cops want to hear that? And how many cops want to go out and take a risk going into a club at night or going into a domestic relations fight when they're going to end up the bad guy? The crime rate's going up. And everybody could have told you it was going to go. You start putting down the police, crime's going to go up. The police are not going to stick their lives on the line every night with the same aggressiveness they would have and should have. And I've said this before everywhere. 911 means I got problems, I need the police. I want a strong, aggressive, courageous police officer to come into this situation and save me. That's what I want. And I think that talking consequences and the double consequences of a lot of this policy is what you don't hear on any of the shows, that this also means this. Defund police also means rising crime. It does. Spending trillions of dollars could mean inflation. They don't talk about that. Everybody talks about the price tags or the something else, but they don't all talk about and they don't argue. I think the argument is, even I think that in college I wrote in the book, I was arguing Matthews. That was my nickname. Arguing in the cafeteria. But I had fun doing it, and everybody with me had fun doing it. But I think that's missing. An honest disagreement, you don't hear on the talk shows.
And you say argument, like argument in the academic sense. Look, I never actually saw your show. As the one thing I didn't get about Saturday Night Live when they made fun of you, and not made fun of you, they were celebrating you. You know, it was flattering, of course, but it was like it was just this caricature that did not actually work for me because your show was, you know, reasonable, interesting people exchanging ideas. It wasn't a shout match. At least it may have had the name Hardball. That was my takeaway. I know people have different takeaways. What I'm saying is there were arguments, they were well-reasoned, and they were interesting, and you could follow them.
I'm a listener, and my mistake and my bad manners over the years was I interrupted people because halfway through the sentence I heard what they were going to say, and I challenged it. I was listening. I picked up on what they were saying really quickly, and I didn't want to waste time having all the extra words. And I said, I know where you're going. Let's go. Let's argue about that. But I think I think this concierge television is not helpful to the American mind. To have people turn on shows that they agree with all the time, without exceptions. Everybody gets the blue plate special. I agree with you on climate, on race, on law and order. I agree with you on foreign policy. How come everybody accepts the entire right wing or left wing line? That's what I don't get. Why do you? I think people say, well, on abortion I disagree, or on law and order I disagree. I'm pro cop, but I'm a liberal. I mean, why does anybody come on with a new sort of distillation? And you never hear anybody saying that, man or woman, or whatever ethnic background. Nobody says, you know, I'm not quite the lefty you think I am because I disagree with this thing. Everybody has to sell the line and tote the line.
Hmm.
That's what I don't like. And that's just a guess. And I think the anchors accommodated because, you know, on the network I work for, MSG, they get complaints like, why do you have Republicans on your show? I go, what?
Right.
What do you mean? Because they're part of the country. They're in half the country in these elections. And that's what we're talking about. The disagreements we're having. That's what we talk about in politics. But they're now, they're groomed and nurtured in the idea that you can turn on a network and listen to it for 5 hours and they'll agree with you on everything.
Yeah, it's well, the way you summarize it, yeah, that's not good for democracy or it doesn't even sound like good television. Hey, your brother.
Well, I talked to people. I was with some people this weekend who still don't know any Trumpites personally. You know, I have three brothers voted for Trump the first time. One switched to Buttigieg, Herb switched to Buttigieg, and Jim and Bruce still voted for Trump in 2020.
Wait, I'm sorry, did you say these are your brothers?
Yeah, my brothers.
Yeah.
I mean, and their wives, as far as I know.
By the way, I wanted to ask you about, what are your brothers, you write about them in the book, growing up, where are they now, what do they do?
Well, they're mostly retired. I think they're all like retired. Yeah. Charlie's still doing real estate. Herb's retired. Jim, you know, still has he sort of runs, there's a big building. He has, he's in real estate, I guess. And he still has ownership of a mortgage company. Yeah. And Bruce is retired. Charlie's not retired. No, Herb's retired. So two retired, two aren't fully retired.
And, hey, towards the end of the book, there are two things that just freaked me out over the past couple of years in public life. I mean, really freaked me out, really scared me. The Kavanaugh hearings, where a woman could come forward with absolutely no evidence whatsoever, and the entire country would stop and watch. And if that guy went down, I think that would have been one of the worst things that ever happened in America. It would have made everybody vulnerable. You know, I didn't go to Yale Law School. You know, I don't know if I could have the beautiful sterling references that he had for that job. If he had gone down, I think that would have been the worst thing for this country. And quite frankly,
well, the thing about that, and I don't know a lot about courtroom evidence gathering, but the fact that the witness against her, the victim, if you will, didn't remember the place or the time really of the incident. But you came across as a person who totally believed in what she was testifying to. So, you know, I don't know how often that happens in courtrooms. I don't know. I assume one of the reasons that he was able to get through confirmation was that she didn't have that information. But she certainly came across as not appealing, credible, and probably appealing to a lot of people. I don't know. It's a tough one. If I said to myself, I don't believe that ever happened, I can't come to that conclusion. I can't. What it constitutes, that's a question. See, the members of the committee had to decide the gravity of the case and the other stuff that came forward. They had to decide these things. More stuff's coming out about the Kavanaugh now. I keep hearing about stuff that was suppressed. And, I mean, you know, I see the guy on Sunday. He's a lector at my church, the Blessed Sacrament. You know, he does some of the readings. You know, it's whatever.
And then when you left MSNBC, and it's in your book, you have that paragraph, and, you know, something was said, and in my opinion, it was innocuous, and that someone, anyone, can kind of hold a weapon in their pocket and use it whenever they want, not having addressed it at the time. I mean, a lot of people are vulnerable. If that's the standard, a lot of people are vulnerable. And if you don't want to talk about it, but I just want you to know that it wasn't just about you. It was a lot of other men watching who were worried and thought this was kind of outrageous. And if you were, you know, I don't know if you like Bob Carroll, Robert Carroll, the biographer.
Oh, sure. Amazing guy. I was working on the third or the fourth book.
Yeah. I like him a lot. But you know what? There was this thing about Robert Moses, and it came out later that he sensed that his power was waning. You know, Robert Moses was getting old, and Robert Moses, you know, was on the way out. And I think that observation totally changed the narrative of that book. And, you know, look, you were 73, old, making a lot of money, older. You know, you were possibly vulnerable internally. And anyway, that's for me. We don't have to talk about that. But
well, I was 74, actually. I was 74. And I'm an honest guy. I really, that's one thing I'll say. And I, confronted by this, I just said, I'm going to be honest here. It never occurred to me not to be honest. And weighing the gravity of it all is up to everybody. And I was with my wife, Kathleen, and the head of the network, and I just said, I'm quitting. I'm retiring. And I didn't like, I tried to be honest about the whole thing, and I didn't knock anybody. I didn't knock the person who made a report to this. I didn't knock anybody. I just wanted to do the best I could at the time. And I'm sure I'll think about it in other ways later on. Who knows? But thank you for being supportive in that regard. I think there, you know, I've heard that view too. Right?
Yeah.
A lot of it has to do with generation, has to do with gender, but mostly generation. And I just have to be honest. Yeah. I have to be honest about it.
Can I also be honest? There's some great tips in this book and in Life's a Campaign, just for anybody in any profession about, you know, kind of getting ahead and living life, you know, asking people for things.
Yeah, I'm going to try to use that. I'm trying to, I'm putting together a course I've been teaching in Vietnam. I'm a distinguished professor of American politics and media at the Fulbright University of Vietnam, and I'm also going to work for a major American university this spring of next year, and I'm putting together my syllabus. And I've tried to turn everything into a lesson and teaching. I'm trying to find permanent value in what I've been through, what I did with the book Hardball when I first started. I'm always trying to find something classic that will endure, you know, like Casablanca is always going to be a great movie. I want to be able to write books that keep a great Gatsby. I want to be able to write nonfiction that meets the test of time. And that's why I read about books on Bobby and Kenny and Tip and Reagan and all my books. I'm hopeful that they will. This one, this country, my life in politics and history, I want them to last. You know, that's what I'm doing. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Chris. I've had you for an hour. I should probably wrap it up. Thank you so much. And
it's been a great hour. Hey. A lot of challenge for me. It was not concierge. It was good.
Again, the book, Chris Matthews, This Country, My Life in Politics and History. Chris has moved on. He's going to be just fine financially. I'm sure he is already. There are some other folks, though, who, particularly on the conservative side, to make your life, your life's work as a writer, is very, very hard. That is tough stuff. A full-time writer, the kind of money that takes, the money that's gettable, it's all kind of hard. And I think it's very important to support some of these up-and-coming writers, whether or not you read the book. You don't have. So keep that. We'll pick that up the next time we talk. I hope you're having a great August. Check me out on the Newsmax show and on WABC Radio, 1 to 3 in the afternoon. And, of course, on Twitter, at Greg Kelly USA, at Greg Kelly USA. All the best and many thanks.